Now it's time for our weekly check-in on national politics. We're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. Well, the other one, when the electors cast their final votes for President-elect Donald Trump. Probably. There's some movement in other directions. And Congress could be facing some budget challenges when they begin in January, especially congressional Democrats.
Also, President-elect Trump has continued naming people to his cabinet as he transitions to the White House, including former rival Ben Carson to the Housing and Urban Development post.
Paul Singer joins us now to talk about national politics. He's the Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Good. Well, let's start with this parade of cabinet appointments and near appointments. Dr. Ben Carson, formerly Donald Trump's rival on the packed Republican presidential field, now Department of Housing and Urban Development. There's talk of, you know, well, he's a doctor, Health and Human Services. That's not going to happen. What are people saying about this announcement?
The Carson one's a bit of a head scratcher. Normally look to a cabinet appointment for somebody who has relevant experience in that area or relevant management experience for that matter. Carson at one point during this process had indicated that he didn't feel like he had sufficient management experience to run any government agency and had sort of taken himself out of the running for HHS. This one is a little odd because he has no relevant public housing experiences other than the fact that he lived in public housing when he was a child. So I honestly don't know. I mean, the conversation around Washington has been that, obviously Ben Carson's a very smart guy and a very accomplished fellow. He's not accomplished in this area. So it'll be interesting to see how he manages HUD. Now, I will say that HUD is the sort of federal agency that everybody ignores. It is frequently treated as a backwater where your primary goal as the Secretary of Housing is to not get indicted.
And there had been on that Ben Carson had grown up in a public housing that was out there for a while. Turns out people who had initially said no, that isn't true. He'd grown up in a poverty-stricken area, but not in public housing itself. So this was bouncing around out there again.
Raises this whole question of so what exactly is the relevance of his experience that makes him a good choice, right? And we can't quite figure it out.
And then moving on to other appointments, we're hearing noises, it seems likely a couple more appointments coming along. Marine General retired John Kelly is head of the Department of Homeland Security, joining other generals on Donald Trump's main team. Trump got some attention when he said he was smarter than the generals when it came to figuring out a plan to tackle ISIS. He's bringing a lot of those generals on board now.
Yeah, and he's picking General Mattis, a former Marine, for the Defense Department, which, there's some discussion about. There's a technical loophole there that Congress has to waive in order to allow Mattis to take that position. You're supposed to be out of uniform 7 years before you can take that position, and he's only been out, I think, 3 or 4. So, it's kind of strange that he's ending up with a pretty heavy general-dominated cabinet. He's also got General Mike Flynn, right, who is going to be his national security advisor. So, you would say, on one hand, that it's good that he is getting advice of people who are well-versed in the area where we have some great concerns in national security. On the other hand, there have been significant concerns raised that is he sort of having too militarized a cabinet? I obviously offer no opinions on that front, but it is worth considering. For what it's worth, he also just recently, in the past hour, named Scott Pruitt, who is the Oklahoma Attorney General, to be the head of EPA. Again, a controversial pick because he is seen as somebody who is very friendly with the oil industry, which makes the environmentalists a little crazy.
Right. That's the other one I wanted to get to today. People have pointed out that in some key posts, Donald Trump has taken people who oppose a lot of what they're going to manage. So in this case, the EPA, someone who opposes a lot of their current regulations, Health and Human Services, someone very devoted to overturning Obamacare, other things like that. So we're getting some pretty strong signals from a lot of these appointments, aren't we?
We are, but I wouldn't make a whole lot of that as being out of the ordinary. And keep in mind that, you know, Republicans in general over the past 20 years have had significant concerns about the growth of government and the growth of regulation. And so Republican administrations frequently end up appointing people to head these agencies that the agency advocates consider to be enemies of the cause. That's not all that unusual. But it is a statement once again that change is coming in Washington. There will be, I think, a very significant change in policy between the Obama administration and, say, the Energy Department or the EPA in the Obama administration, and the Energy Department of the EPA in a Trump administration. There will be a change.
One spot we don't know who's going to be there. A lot of names out there still. Secretary of State, Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, the list goes on. What are the latest rumblings on that?
Well, I heard your name for that one.
if selected, I will serve. Sure,
right,
why not?
Exactly.
What does that pay?
You know,
I don't know what the pay is on that, but...
I don't know either. I'm not sure what the cabinet pays for Secretary of State, but you get good travel benefits and then all the frequent flyer miles you can have. I mean, I think at this point it is up to Donald Trump alone, obviously, to make these decisions. And he keeps dropping little hints. This morning he said something along the lines of, yeah, I've ruled some of those people out, but I'm not going to tell you which ones. To some degree, I think he enjoys the drama of this, the kind of game show quality. It's weird, but... You know, you just have to wait to see what he chooses, and it's frequently the case that it is really who he is most comfortable with, who he feels he has a rapport with. I personally would be stunned if he chose Mitt Romney, given what Mitt Romney has said about him in the past. Although there are, I think, Republicans who would be very comforted by a Mitt Romney choice, because Romney is seen as kind of level-headed and diplomatic in ways that Trump is not. So maybe that comes into some sort of account. I do not know. But no, we're just waiting for the shoe to drop.
Talking to national politics with Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today and rumored contender for the Secretary of State position, according to a rumor I just now started. We'll pick up that conversation in just a few moments. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Right now, we continue our weekly check-in on the latest political happenings in Washington.
Paul Singer stays with us, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, let's turn to Congress now. Republican majorities in both houses with a president who will presumably sign their legislation. What are you looking for out of the starting gates?
Well, the first thing, obviously, is to get this Congress done with, and so they're passing a spending bill in the next couple of days and try to wrap that up. You know, the very first thing out of the box I'm expecting early next year will be some kind of Obamacare repeal provision. Now, Speaker Paul Ryan has been pretty clear that it will take some time to fully repeal and replace Obamacare over time. It's not easy, and they have to come up with legislation that will fix all of it, but it would not surprise me in the least to see them come up with some kind of a bill, even a what they call a budget reconciliation bill that can pass without needing to sustain a filibuster, just 51 votes. They could do that in early January and have some provision in there that would repeal Obamacare. You know, one of the things that has been pointed out is that any number of things that they might want to start doing first thing out the door in January, they might have to hold these bills for a little while because obviously they have to wait until President Trump takes office to sign them.
And then on the Democratic side, there's been some talk of whether they want to go full-on obstructionist as much as they can with minorities, but a filibuster possibility in the Senate, or if they want to look for room for cooperation on things like infrastructure spending.
Right. I mean, I think there's some places where Democrats certainly do want to look for cooperation. They'd like to be able to get some stuff done. And some of the things that President-elect Trump is interested in are things that Democrats have a lot of interest in, whether it is infrastructure spending, whether it is, in some cases, renegotiating trade deals, whether it is, you know, some of the tax reform elements that he's interested in. I think they're not interested in all of them, but they might be interested in some of them. So there's places, I think, that Democrats are going to find opportunities to work with the Republicans, and they want to. They you obviously got to save some of your fire for the battles that really matter, like a Supreme Court nomination, for instance, is one that I suspect they will go to the mat on. But I think there are some areas where you'd be surprised at how much bipartisan cooperation we're going to get, which might be kind of fun to watch for a little while because it's been a while since we've seen it.
Here's an issue that's coming up again this week where Donald Trump and congressional Republicans might see some difference. Donald Trump's work with the carrier plant, helping work out a deal apparently with Indiana state money to keep some jobs from moving out of the country, and then tweeting and talking about punitive tariffs on companies that move jobs outside of the United States, 35% tariffs. This is not the kind of talk that a lot of Republicans have liked to hear in the past.
Well, and Donald Trump's entire campaign flipped a lot of Republican orthodoxy on its head. All this free trade stuff, the NAFTA Trans-Pacific Partnership, this is stuff that Republicans liked. It's a sort of classic Chamber of Commerce agenda. So, you know, the places where he's finding allies now on some of the trade opposition, people like Sherrod Brown, a liberal from Ohio, it's just kind of odd. So, yeah, there will be some issues where Donald Trump is going to want to move, and Republicans in his own party are going to say we're not so sure. There, by the way, you will see the same problem with an infrastructure bill, where Donald Trump is going to want to say, let's spend a lot of money on, you know, bridges, airports, and highways, and you're going to find a lot of Republicans who are going to say, hold it. We have a concern about, once again, exploding the deficit, exploding federal spending.
And, Paul, I wanted to get your thoughts on an issue. You've tweeted some things about this over the last week. Fake news, completely made-up news stories making the rounds in social media, or conspiracy theories with very little background. We're going to have a conversation on Central Time about this on Friday. But from where you're sitting, working for USA Today, what are you making of this apparent rise in fake news?
You know, it's really interesting, Rob, that what we're seeing more and more of is a willingness of people to accept news that is clearly fictitious, reject news that is based in fact, and dismiss anything they see that contradicts their views, their beliefs, as some kind of a conspiracy. And it's been a real challenge. I mean, writing about Hillary Clinton's health, for example, was one of these issues where any time you said, well, Hillary Clinton isn't actually sick, you'd get deluged with emails and angry calls saying, yeah, she is, and they'd link you to all kinds of made-up symptoms that she was apparently having. It is impossible to have a meaningful conversation about policy if we don't agree that the basic facts matter. And that's what is worrisome to me, is that in some cases we are concluding that basic facts don't matter. It's my beliefs that matter, and to heck with what's actually true.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
We're talking to Paul Singer, Washington correspondent at USA Today. He joined us to give us some of the latest in politics from Congress to the presidential transition.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Sexual violence on college campuses has received a lot of national attention in the last couple of years, and schools across the U.S. are creating new policies to try to deal with the problem. On Monday, UW System President Ray Cross announced his approval of sexual violence prevention training for all students and employees at UW System schools.
This program comes as part of a more comprehensive policy on sexual violence and harassment across campuses in the system. A task force commissioned in 2014 recommended this training, as well as other policies, to help prevent sexual violence on campus. The Office for Civil Rights of the U.S. Department of Education has been investigating both UW-Madison and UW-Whitewater for their officials' handling of sexual assault complaints.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue, sexual harassment, sexual violence on campus, that has affected you, your friends, or your family? How would you like to see campus culture, UW on any campus for that matter, help prevent sexual violence and support victims? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stephanie Marquis joins us now to talk about this training and other recommendations from the task force. She's the interim director of communications for the UW system, and she works for system president Ray Cross. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me to talk about this important issue. We really appreciate it.
Well, a national survey reported in 2015 that one in four women at UW-Madison reported experiencing sexual assault while they were enrolled as students at the university. Is that part of why the task force is recommending this new action?
Well, what you'll see here is that what President Cross did is he didn't just look at UW-Madison or Whitewater, as you mentioned, but actually looked at all the campuses. They do say nationally those statistics about one in five women and actually one in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. But the sad thing here is about 90% of the victims don't report these assaults. And I think what's really important here, and I think this is really the crux of the conversation, is these aren't statistics. These are real people. These are our sisters, our friends, our daughters, our sons. And what we're really looking for is how do we prevent this and how do we have folks, if they were to be an unfortunate victim of a sexual assault or sexual harassment, how do they feel empowered to report those type of things? And what we're looking at and what the report did and this task force really did is they tried to look at this comprehensively, not just for one institution, but across all of our campuses and looked at how can we do some real tangible things to tackle these issues, tackle these challenges, because, again, these are real people, these are real lives that are impacted, and there's really a stigma against people reporting these things. And just, you know, as a woman who's got almost a half century under her belt, I can tell you, you know, in talking to my girlfriends, that whether it was in high school or college or work or in some sort of, you know, you're out and about and you've had somebody make a comment or unfortunately, you know, do something worse. And it's all of those things that we really need to not only tackle campus culture, but how do we, and tackling campus culture, really deal with this socially as well. This is obviously a big social issue. We care about it in our campuses. They should be a safe place to live, to work, to learn, and there's no compromise for that. That needs to be a basic necessity. So what can we do from a system-wide perspective? And some of the things that really came out of that, one of the most basic things is just making sure that everybody has training. And training can sound kind of blasé.
Right. What kind of training are we talking about?
So I think it's stuff that's really important. It's for employees and for students. But it's talking about healthy relationships. I think that's really important for people to understand what's healthy, what's not. If you're a bystander, you know, how do you intervene at those points? I think that if somebody sees an assault happening, there's kind of more of an immediate reaction to, you know, somebody's being hurt, I want to jump in. But I think we've all, or most people, have been in a situation where you see somebody say something, and you kind of say to yourself, did that just happen? I'm not sure if that just happened. And sometimes people can feel like they want to be polite or they're not sure if what they just saw happened. So it's how do we intervene? It's about making sure that we look at all the factors, again, of alcohol and drug abuse, and just making sure that people know what the resources are that are available to them. So students will get this in the first 6 weeks. That's already underway.
I mean, do we know what sort of training it would look like? Would this be small groups and in person? Would it be online? What kind of options are you considering?
So primarily we're looking for online, but of course there will be in person as well, particularly for supervisors and managers and so forth from the employee perspective. But what we're looking at is really these online tools, because we know that, first of all, that makes it much more accessible for our students, that makes it accessible for everyone to get to, and that helps also people complete that easily and quickly. So that's one of the primary tools that we'll be using. But obviously, again, there are going to be some needs for some enhanced training for our supervisors and so forth. And I should note, I mean, many of this is already happening on our campuses, but it's about how can we do this comprehensively to make sure everybody's got access to the same resources, is getting the same training, hearing, you know, the same issues, dealing with the same issues, and what can we do with the best practices that we learn from that, not only from a college perspective, but we also want to work with our stakeholders from like the K-12 schools and the tech colleges and private colleges and say, you know, what have you learned that works really well? What do people respond to? And those type of things. So it's really about trying to make sure we get the information out there, that people know where they go for resources, They know where they can get help. They know where, if they want to report, how they do all of those things. So it's really about making sure that all of that is available to people very quickly and easily in a way that they can comprehend and understand very easily as well, because it's a very emotional issue.
Online training certainly makes sense for all the reasons that you said. And on the other hand, it can also be easy to sort of tune out something that's happening on your computer when you're not necessarily interacting with a real human being, hearing stories. And sexual violence on college campuses, it's almost an epidemic now. Maybe some people would call it an epidemic. I mean, do you think that maybe there would be a place to go farther than an online course and make it more immersive for students and for staff?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is part of this as well. I mean, without a doubt, that those in-person and having those support groups and having that additional training, of course, that's certainly part of what we're looking at as well. You know, one thing that was really important when we put this task force together is it wasn't just some people in a few offices. We really pulled in our counseling and health services staff and our LGBTQ community and student services and law enforcement and HR and disability services and all the different ways that people may reach out, the people who communicate with students, and really how do we certainly implement best practices, but how do we reach out and how do we reach those people? Like you said, you know, there are too many stories of this. One incident, of course, is more than anyone wants to see, and it's heartbreaking. And we all know, whether it's male or female, for the most part, obviously, the females is more prevalent for women. But it happens to men as well, and there's also stigmatism there where men, you know, are certainly afraid to come forward and say that they were assaulted. So it's about really creating safe environments for people to come forward, to feel empowered to report. Obviously, it's about trying to change the culture to begin with, to help prevent it as much as we can, and really utilizing all these various tools that we have, from websites to in-person training, as you're talking about, to support groups, to services, all of those things combined, and not just doing it at one campus, but making sure that that's available across all of our campuses. And while each campus may have some of their own unique needs, that there's also this very strong base of materials and resources available to everyone.
I want to ask you about the culture that might sort of lend itself to sexual assault. And one thing that a lot of experts point to is drinking culture. And Wisconsin has a strong drinking culture in the university, sometimes to excess. UW often appears on the top 10 lists of party schools. Mm-hmm. What do you intend to do to approach that aspect of it?
Well, certainly that is going to be part of all of this training and these resources as well, because as you mentioned, sometimes alcohol can be a factor. And I think the important thing there to know is that's not an excuse. That's, you know, that's never a reason for someone or allow somebody to assault someone else. It doesn't create that window, but certainly it is something, as you mentioned, part of our culture, is part of college culture. You know, for many students, it may be the first time that they're really away from home and they're, you know, sowing their wild oats a little bit. And again, that doesn't mean that anyone should fall victim to any of this. But it's really trying to also help people understand just a little bit about alcohol and drug addiction, period, so that they really begin to understand those cultures. But I think part of the culture that you have, particularly that we want to address and that we want to really tackle, is this really this culture of victims not feeling that they can come forward and that they can't report and that they don't feel empowered. And again, we know that that's a social issue and it's a very sad commentary on our society.
Right. And what will the UW do to turn that around, to make victims of sexual assault feel like they can report it? And not only that, but they will be heard and that there will be some sort of action taken.
Right, exactly. So I think that's, first of all, I think the basic of that is, I don't know that everyone knows what those resources are and where they actually go and who they can turn to. So the first part is making, you know, people aware and students aware or employees aware of where they go to actually report those issues. So again, that will be part of this training we'll roll out. It'll be part of our website. It's going to have reporting information on there, everything from obviously, you can call 911 if there's something immediate, to your campus police department. But, you know, how do you get those health resources on your campus? Who do you go to for counseling? You know, all of those things, walking people through the process, helping them understand what the process is. And I think, unfortunately, I don't think this is going to be anything that happens overnight. Well, I think this is a really important step in the right direction, and it's talking about how do we really tackle this across the system. And I know there's a few universities across the nation that are doing that and are really tackling that from a system perspective. I think that's a really important piece so that we don't have any lapses of information and so forth. So I think part of a big piece about people reporting is, one, knowing where to go, and two, changing a culture that we really encourage people to tell. You know, tell if something happens to you and tell if you see it. Again, I think when people think of sexual assaults and harassment, they often think of, again, those violent rapes or something more violent to that nature. But we also need to really be paying attention to, you know, inappropriate comments that people make, inappropriate touches that people make if they're out in a bar. You know, that as a bystander, we don't just simply stand by that either, that we really feel empowered to stand up, that both men and women feel empowered to do that. And I think that's a key to this as well. So I think it's not going to be a ship that we can turn overnight, but I think this is a step in the right direction, and I think it's really important that we had all these different type of communities involved in this so that it's not a top-down type of effort, but it really is a ground-up and involves those services and those individuals that are dealing with students or dealing with employees that actually report.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Stephanie Marquis, Interim Director of Communications for the UW System, who works for System President Ray Cross. And she joined us to talk about the news that President Cross has just approved sexual violence prevention training for all students and employees at the University of Wisconsin System.